Welcome to this week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with myself, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined by Joe Kirk, Double Trouble this week.
Hello.
Hiya. Yeah, Phil couldn't join us this week. He's, where is he? Bishop Auckland. Auckland, close enough. Yeah, he's somewhere, not here anyway. But we coped without him. It was a fun session. We really delved into some topics this week, went down a few rabbit holes as ever. And we got some great feedback from the chat as ever these days as well, which was really nice. So yeah, how do you think it went, Joe? What were your thoughts? What were your highlights?
Yeah, I thought it was a really enjoyable session, actually. It's always quite a change of pace going from three people to two, because you know it's you got one less person to kind of rely on to help dig you out. But all things considered, I thought it was a great session. We covered lots of topics actually, and delved quite deeply into others. AI was a prominent feature as always,
including Miles's relationship with AI.
Yeah, and his ChatGPT to create him a Valentine's card. I think my highlight was probably towards the end when I bought my case in that I've had from a customer around a supposed breach and whether it actually constitutes a breach or whether it's even caught by the GDPR at all. So yeah, I enjoyed that, and I recommend listening out for that.
Yeah, I did too, to be fair. It was a tricky one. It was one of those, you know, where you feel a little bit on the spot when it comes around. Yeah. That's really interesting. Anyway, to the room.
Well, I got that on a call. I was sat there like, you know, so much to unpack, isn't there? And it's like always in our line of work, the devil's always in the detail, isn't it?
The devil's always in the it depends. but yeah, I mean, we covered a lot on AI again as well. So there's been some news around Gemini and concerns around its data protection practices. The EU AI Act has been, I don't know if you'd say approved, but it's been voted in favour at least at the moment. What else was there on AI? We'll let you find that out in the session. We also spoke about the Digital Markets Act, tried to unpick that one, and what gatekeepers are and how we and, you know, large organisations and even smaller ones might be affected by that, which I'll be keen to see how that travels to UK legislation as well. And we spoke a little bit about ROPAs again, as ever.
Yeah, no, I thought it was a great session, but let's not give too much away.
No, these are the contents. But yeah, we'll let you listen in and hope that you enjoy it. And we'll be back next week for a session on third parties, part two. So yeah, we'll look forward to seeing you then as well. But in the meantime, hope you enjoy the session. Know if you've got any problems with that after the session, and yes, let's make a start. I think that's everything.
Lovely. Yeah. Jasmine, how's your week been?
It's been good. I feel like you're filling into Phil's shoes here. It's been good. It's been really busy, to be fair, gearing up for the end of the financial year, but in and amongst that, I mentioned it, I think, last week. Was I even here last week or the one before? A document to all of my customers. So some free advice on what I called the road to data protection compliance. It was, I suppose, highlighting the main points that you need to consider under the GDPR and data protection law. But it wasn't exhaustive, but it was just because a lot of my customers have a wide range of knowledge of an understanding of data protection. So I thought, let me send this out so everybody's on the same page and can at least reference that if needed. I tried to speak in, you know, as simple terms as possible to reach as many people as possible. So I think it went all right.
Yeah. How was it? Did you get quite a bit of feedback from customers or?
I got some positive feedback, to be fair. A couple of people said that they'd take it to board. It had helped them take some of their arguments for stronger data protection measures and budget and so on to the board, because I highlighted the risks in it for non-compliance with the different areas. So So yeah, it was good. It was good. And then a few people are using it themselves to prepare for audits and things. So
oh, nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds like a really useful tool, to be fair.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's all right. Yeah, it's good. And then what else I've been doing? I've been gearing up for the data protection management training that's happening in a couple of weeks as well. So that starts on the 5th of March. So all guns blazing. If anyone wants to know more information about that, I'll put a link in the chat actually for a information sheet. I'll just find it. But what about you, Joe? What have you been up to?
My week has been unorthodox, to say the least, but when is it not at DPP? I have started a new project with a customer of ours. They require quite a bit of support because the main data protection contact there is off unwell. So I've been asked to essentially work 3 days a week for them.
You've just gone off one and onto another.
As a DPO, literally gone off from one into another. And so that's been a little bit of an adjustment, trying to, you know, get organised and on top of all that. And then I'm also deep into a ROFA project at the moment with another one of our customers. Mm. And I've got Rofi shadowing me on that. So lots to learn, as always, in a role of data protection, but always good fun as well.
Yeah. How's the project going?
Which one?
The ROFA project.
Yeah, the ROFA project's going good. It's again pushing me into things that I've probably not done before, in terms of thinking just beyond completing the ROFA, you know, the work outstanding, you know, beyond that, and highlighting the sort of risks that, okay, so say for example, we've identified a purpose of processing, the special category data involved, and, you know, we've identified that DPA needs to be carried out, but, you know, beyond that, setting that sort of up and going just that one step further. So yeah, it's been good. It's been a learning curve, but, you know, I think every day is a learning curve, really.
Yeah, I find that, you know, with, say, for example, if we review a data processing agreement, you think you're getting the hang of them until, you know, you get your next one and it's completely different to the one prior and you just feel like inadequate again. But yeah, I think, to be honest, I saw on the topic of ROFAs, the IAPP published a article on tips on creating a comprehensive ROFA. Did you read that?
I did, yeah, I did see that. And there was actually a few things in there that I quite liked. So the first one that I saw was they suggested that you create a standard naming convention for a ROFA and other entries, including data protection impact assessments and so on. And they said that this should make it easier for the business to update entries instead of creating new ones. And what I like about this is more the fact that I've not really thought about it before. And it's actually this project that I'm doing at the minute. I think they call it the building of central business processes, which is a little bit of a mouthful. And it's something that I've struggled to get to grips with, obviously, because we're so used to calling it a ROFA. But obviously, internally to them and to all the people, you know, that work within the organization that don't really understand what a ROFA is and what's required, it's probably a better term to use. But
yeah.
Another thing that was in there was to ensure that your ROFA not only meets requirements of the GDPR regulation Article 30, but is also a useful document for drafting privacy notices in the jurisdictions where your business operates. Obviously, because jurisdictions around the world pass new data protection laws or strengthen existing ones. So again, that's not really something that I've considered before in terms of, you know, going beyond what you've got on there. And I know we always say to try and be as transparent as possible, but if you're an organization that's working across multiple different territories around the world, then, you know, it might be a good idea to have beyond your Article 30 requirements, just some text boxes of what's required to meet, you know, other legislation out there in terms of, you know, different laws and stuff. And then the final thing that I saw was to create rules in the document to trigger tasks for high-risk processing. So I guess it is just automating the ROFA process of if you meet certain threshold that you've set, that obviously then stipulates a DPIA, for example, then it will trigger a thing that says a DPIA must be completed. Or if you if you select legitimate interest as your lawful basis, it will pop up saying a requirement for an LIA is to be carried out before the processing commences, for example. But I thought it was really good. Some really useful tips in there.
No, that's a really good point, because I mean, we were talking earlier this week, weren't we, about identifying risks as put in, you know, within a ROPA project. It can be a risk in and of itself if you don't have a proper mechanism in place to record any risks or even just subsequent actions to come from a ROPA. Yeah. I suppose with us, we're used to understanding what might come from it through a lack of information that when compiling the ROPA, but in moving forward, you know, you want to have something clear that sets out exactly what you need to be doing following that. So I suppose it depends on the software that you're using, whether if you've got just an Excel spreadsheet, maybe just creating another spreadsheet with a tab for each department and the row of actions that are required within that department. There might be some that overlap, like lawful basis or retention, and, you know, that aren't really consistent across the organisation. But just having that from the offset, I think, is a really organised approach.
Yeah, it's definitely a good idea, because I think when you complete a ROPA, or if you, you know, for us, we go into organisations and a lot of these processing activities are already happening, and we're going in there and we're populating, you know, the things that they're up to into a ROPA. It's good to get out the mindset of it more than just being filling in the spreadsheet. Like you say, being organised and having a table of risks is a great way of kind of, you know, moving the project along from filling in the ROPA to then the actions that, you know, follow the risks that you've identified.
Yeah, because that's the biggest part, isn't it, really, most of the time. It's I wouldn't say it's amusing, that's a bit mean, but you know, when you complete a ROPA project and the person that we're helping thinks, oh, okay, we're all done now, we're compliant, and it's just a start. Obviously it's probably the most tedious part of it, or the most time consuming part of a compliance project, to get all of that information down, recorded in one place, and, you know, leaning into everyone across the organization for their support in completing it. But yeah, there's a bit of more of a journey after that.
Well, once it's done though, everything else around that is a lot easier, isn't it? You know, updating your privacy policies and things like that. It's so easy, because you just nip into your ROPA, you have a look at the purposes that you're processing, and you stick them into your privacy policy, you find your lawful basis, you put them in there, and then you follow up with the subsequent the purposes along with the lawful basis, and it just harmonizes everything for you as an organization, doesn't it?
I think that point that you mentioned about the naming conventions as well is absolutely vital, because you bring in different different departments in the organization and so on who don't really have an understanding of data protection. So there's the chance that if you know, left to their own devices, they'll have different ways of categorizing things, naming things, understanding things, all of that. So if you define these, say for example, define what you would call third parties, whether that's recipients or et cetera, or go even more granular and say, okay, what are we defining contact details as in categories of personal data? You know, can that be name, phone number, email? Is it any more than that or less? And if you have those in, I suppose, an introductory tab on a ROPA, then it makes life a lot easier moving forward.
Yeah, certainly, and obviously. It. Yeah, and you back that up, can't you, as well, with an internal process to document instructions to hand out to people. But before we turn this into a ROPA session, and before we move on, you know, we have highlighted that ROPAs can be quite tricky. I think we've actually got some training coming up, haven't we, Jasmine, on ROPAs?
Yeah.
So I think it's in April. So if anyone wants any more information on that, just drop us an email at info@dataprotectionpeople.com and we'll get some information sent out to you.
Yeah, it'll be more than us ranting week in, week out about ROPAs. There's, you know, like Joe says in the comments, thanks Fiona, just put me off that. Like Peter says in the comments, that we make it sound so easy, and you know, it's by no means easy, when just even through dealing with people with regard to data protection, and that relates again to us always trying to push, you know, the making it relevant to individuals, and really I'm getting sidetracked by these comments. We need three people on this session. But yeah, just making it relevant to everyone so they can get on board and they can understand the importance of it or something like that. So anyway, moving on in the news. So the UK regulator, the ICO, has warned websites, you might have heard this already, to proactively make advertising cookies compliant following previous calls to action. So they initially sent out 100 letters, or they wrote to 100 organisations to warn them that, you know, the cookie compliance isn't up to scratch and they've got so long to complete it. So they've come back and said that it's been a really successful exercise and that they will continue to do this, you know, with the next 100 and then the next 100 after that and so on. So, you know, who goes to show when you actually are proactive, it has a positive effect. So hopefully that will, you know, spread to other areas of data protection compliance anyway.
Yeah, fingers crossed. And I think cookies is something that, you know, the ICO need to get under and get control of, because often when I'm having a look at organisations and I'm conducting due diligence, there's often gaps in people's cookie compliance in terms of the cookie banner not being compliant and the cookie policy just lacks details. So right, I'm going to ignore the chat for now because that's just put me off. Thanks, Dave. I'm trying to do something here. Shouldn't you be on holiday anyway? Why are you tuning into this? besides the point, yeah, cookies. So it's often something that I see, and I'm actually in the process of doing a cookie audit for a customer, and me and Phil are actually taking the lead on it, and it's been quite a complicated process. So the ins and outs of it is essentially that one of our customers has got tons of cookies on their sites, and they just want to understand, you know, what's actually going on with the cookies. Are they doing what they're meant to be doing? And are there any cookies there that are unknown? And they're using OneTrust, a tool from OneTrust that I guess just scans websites, all the pages of the website, and then gives you a comprehensive list of all the cookies and the descriptions and the session, whether like a session cookie or and so on. And to be honest, there's been some inconsistencies with the tool that's been used. Me and Phil have been given a list from last year, and that was, it scanned 1500 pages and it sent back a list of thousands of cookies. And then they came back and sent us a new list in January. But then OneTrust said, oh, you only need to do 1000 pages in order to get, like, you know, the main proper, the main cookies that you have. Proper is obviously not the right word. I'm getting put off by the chat as well. I'm trying to explain something here. And then the next set of the next report that they issued in February, which was another scan of 1000 pages, it generated a list that had different cookies on it. So we're a little bit of to and fro in between us, the customer, and OneTrust. But it, you know, I just wanted to put it out there that cookie compliance is very much something that I think the ICO are going to be cracking down on this year. And I think just to summarize the cookie tool for OneTrust, I probably wouldn't trust it at this moment in time, but we'll update this. We'll update you on that as me and Phil progress through the case.
Peter said in the chat, this is something I'm looking at for my organisation. One thing to watch out on is uncategorised cookies are dropped by default as essential. Worried me when I heard that. And Steph said, did you realise the cookie is 30 years old this year and we still haven't gotten on top of them? We have cookie categorization with the focus on herding cats.
I was not aware of cookies being 30 years old. It's a little bit before mine and your time, Jasmine. I'm sure Phil would have been aware of that, though.
That's a pirate step now as well, you know. No, I'm joking. But yeah, I mean, I think going back to the ICO as well, it's probably one of the easiest ways to enforce the law, because, you know, you can just look on the website and see whether it's compliant or not. So it's probably easy in terms of resource, but I would hope to see more time and effort put into areas, because, to be honest, while obviously, you know, you're still collecting and processing personal data through cookies, I don't think it's one of the biggest risk areas necessarily. I mean, it obviously has potential to be, but I think there's other areas where more effort needs to be spent in ensuring that people's rights and data protection is protected, to be honest, and personal data is protected. So I'm going on a little bit of a rant here.
Yeah, it's hard though, isn't it, to pinpoint one specific area that should probably take priority. I mean, there's, by the sounds of it, there's quite a lot that the ICO need to do in terms of work and trying to work towards compliance. But I guess while we're on the topic of kind of working towards compliance, did you see that the there's a new certification, isn't there, that's come out? I think the ICO approved it from UCAS, is it? Is that something United Kingdom Accreditation Service?
So finally, when people say they're GDPR certified, it might not actually be false. So there is a GDPR certification for the legal services sector that they can evidence their compliance in relation to client data. So I don't think it's got, you know, any new rules. It's basically about evidence and compliance around the GDPR. And yeah, it's quite a positive move, to be honest. I hope to see this branch out across other sectors, and I think it will.
Yeah, it's something that we often say to our customers, isn't it, that if you say you're GDPR compliant, that's probably more of a red flag in itself than being able to demonstrate things, in terms of the fact that there's no real such thing, because the law's always constantly changing and turning. But I'm not sure if you mentioned, I was looking at the chat, there's a lot going on in there, but did you mention that it's specifically for legal service providers in order mm-hmm. to demonstrate the compliance? Yeah.
So they've got, I think, two scopes, so one for controllers and one for processors. But in the main, it looks at processing of personal data in the client file and ensuring protection of client data when shared as well. So for controllers, this would include following types of organizations such as law firms, barristers, and in-house counsel. And for processors, it would include software providers, solution providers, and consultants. So it's called LOCS23, which it stands for Legal Services Operational Privacy Certification Scheme. So I can see why they've shortened that down a little bit, even if it doesn't actually add up.
Yeah, a little bit of a mouthful, that one.
Yeah.
Although, do you know, this frustrated me a little bit seeing this, because I saw in the report online that, you know, they're saying that the legal profession's been in need of a robust security measure such as this. And then this just frustrates me with all these reprimands that are being handed out to the public services sector. You know, rather than giving police forces and NHS slaps on the wrist, why not implement a certification similar to the one they've done for the legal services? I mean, it doesn't have to be as robust, but it could be something along the lines of like the data protection security toolkit that they've got for the NHS.
I mean, well, yeah, I was going to say they've got that, but I think the issue there is more the day-to-day compliance and potentially human error. I think that's probably the biggest risk area in the public services, just due to the pressure on them, maybe. I don't know. Particularly in the NHS, I don't really know if I could say the same for the police. So, you know, you can't really avoid human error, and they're naturally processing extremely sensitive data. So maybe that's, I don't know whether if it was another organization, these things go amiss, because it can be, you know, the risk can be mitigated much easier, or it's much more of a lower level. So it's a tricky one, isn't it? I mean, there are absolute failings that have happened over the years, but
I don't know,
to be honest. I think maybe They do issue enforcement notices, don't they? But it doesn't really seem to be having an effect, because where they'll fix one area, then there's a whole other issue going on here, a whole other fire. It's a tricky one.
Yeah, I guess the issues that are probably around like the public services sector is probably more cultural, as you know, as opposed to like the things that they've got in place. I think probably better training internally, whether that's done through the police forces or the ICO, you know, step up and put some workshops on, for example. But yeah, you're right, it's not necessarily something specific like internally, it's more kind of just human error and the culture around, just a little bit careless, I think. You know, the notebook was left on top of a car, wasn't it, in Northern Ireland? I think that was one of the breaches in the PSNI breach. And it's just kind of just reiterating, isn't it, to your employees about the importance of personal data and that it's everyone's responsibility to keep it protected.
Yeah. And then the hidden cells in Excel as well. That's probably a common one in general, but obviously, like you say, they need more specific or in-depth training around these issues and preventing them. But I mean, we'll see how this new GDPR certification actually works in practice, whether it's effective. I think, to be honest, it's probably going to be similar to, say, a Cyber Essentials or ISO, where it's used as for a competitive advantage, which isn't, you know, necessarily a negative thing if it subjects more organizations to, you know, comply with the GDPR or to take it seriously at least. So I suppose, you know, we'll see how it plays out, but I do hope to see it spread across more sectors.
Yeah, it's definitely a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. What else have you seen then, Joe?
I saw, and I can't remember if I actually mentioned this last week or not, but I saw that the Dutch supervisory authority has fined US-based ride-hailing company Uber €10 million for not fully disclosing data retention details of European drivers and not revealing non-European countries with whom the data is shared. The SA discovered that Uber made it difficult for drivers to access their personal data. The access request form was buried in the app, spread across menus, and could have been placed more logically. So it's quite a big fine, that I saw.
Just going back to the last point as well. So Lynn said, I was excited until I saw the bottom. There are currently no UCAS accredited certification bodies to deliver this scheme. I mean, hopefully they'll catch up quite soon. Another thing I've seen in the news is that 4 Apple and Microsoft services are exempt from the Digital Markets Act. Did you see that?
I did see that. Yeah, quite an interesting one, wasn't it?
Yeah, so I've not really spent the time until today to look into the Digital Markets Act, you know, in detail, but I'd done some background research and got my head around it a little bit, because there's some references that were going over my head. So references to gatekeepers and whatnot. So as a little bit of background, the Digital Markets Act, the DMA, came into force in November 2022 and was applied since May 2023. And it aims to ensure contestable and fair markets in the digital sector. So it regulates gatekeepers, large online platforms that provide an important gateway between business users and consumers, whose position can grant them power to create a bottleneck in the digital economy. So basically, you know, is it the big five? Is that what you call them? You know, the big organizations, technical organizations. So basically Google, I might be making that up, but Google or the big tech or something, Google, Microsoft, Apple, Samsung, I think TikTok maybe in there, I don't know, but there are a few anyway. Obviously Meta, not Facebook, if I said that. So companies providing at least one of the 10 core platform services that are referenced in the DMA are presumed to be gatekeepers if they meet certain criteria. So these core platform services are online intermediation services such as app stores, online search engines, social networking services, certain messaging services, video sharing platform services, virtual assistants, web browsers, cloud computing services, operating systems, etc. I'm getting a bit bored of listing those. So a few organizations, like I've just mentioned, have been highlighted as being caught by these, but this doesn't mean that the organization in and of itself can necessarily be a gatekeeper, but in some, you know, contextual factors in say the services they're providing. So for example, let me think of one. It was in question whether iMessage, for example, would be one. So it was determined, I think this week, that iMessage and Microsoft Search Engine, Bing and Browser Edge, and then Microsoft Advertising would be exempt from this gatekeeper status. So this would mean that they would have to, if, you know, for any gatekeeper, that they would have to comply with strict rules to ensure that their the technology they provide is available to across all or in interfaces with other organizations, softwares and systems and whatnot. So it's a tricky one to explain. If you want to help me out, Joe, you can.
No, you did a great job, but Steph's just actually put something in the chat that he says that he found this resource useful, so we might both have to have a read up of that after. Essentially, yeah, so the ins and outs of it is that organizations, it's kind of just putting a stress on these gatekeepers to ensure that they're being fair essentially to new startups and end users essentially. So they actually provided a list of do's and don'ts. So the examples of the do's for the gatekeeper was that the gatekeeper platform will have to allow third parties to interoperate with the gatekeeper's own services in certain specific situations. The gatekeeper will have to allow the business users to access the data that they generate in their use of the gatekeeper's platform. To provide companies advertising on their platform with the tools and information necessary for advertisers and publishers to carry out their own independent verification of their advertisements hosted by the gatekeeper, and to allow their business users to promote their staff, to promote their offer and conclude contracts with their customers outside the gatekeeper's platforms. And there was also a list of the four things that gatekeepers may no longer treat services and products offered by the gatekeeper itself more favorably in ranking than similar services or products offered by third parties on the gatekeeper's platform. They must no longer prevent consumers from linking up to businesses outside their platforms. And they must no longer prevent users from uninstalling any pre-installed software app if they wish to. And also, they must never track end users outside of the gatekeeper's core platform service for the purpose of targeted advertising without effective consent having been granted.
Yeah, so essentially it helps or prevents organizations from monopolizing certain markets and, you know, say, for example, in the social media area or web browsers, etc. It's something that Google have been, you know, in the news and in the courts for quite a lot over the years, really. They've been fined heavily for, you know, having unfair advantages over these things. So it should control or prevent that from happening. I was looking earlier trying to find some examples of fines that Google have received, and I didn't know which one to pick. It was like 2.4 billion euros or however many billion euros. It was just, there was about four of them. So I just left it.
probably for the best. While we're on the topic of Google, did you see that they're set to establish an AI hub in France? So I think it comes around, expanding its footprint in France. It'll be located in Paris and house around 300 researchers and engineers. A statement by the French finance ministry confirmed that the establishment of the hub underscores France's position as a leading tech centre. The country's president, Emmanuel Macron, has pushed for the growth of the tech sector in France, which has traditionally trailed behind the US and the UK as a software and finance hub.
Right. Well, another thing about Google as well is that Gemini has, finally been released, and it's been, well, there's been some talk about its AI data collection practices and retention practices as well. It's causing some concern, isn't it, Joe?
It is. Yeah. So just a little bit of background. Gemini is now what Google Bard was. So essentially, it's an AI model similar to ChatGPT, where you can just ask it questions and it scans Google and it will pull back, hopefully the answer you're looking for within a couple of seconds. Done a pretty terrible job at explaining that. I'm not the biggest AI fan.
It's like ChatGPT.
It is like ChatGPT, yeah, exactly like ChatGPT. And as you touched on, Jasmine, there's some privacy concerns, because I think they state on the website that we take your privacy very seriously and we do not sell your personal information to anyone. To help Gemini improve while protecting your privacy, we select a subset of conversations and use automated tools to help remove user identifying information, such as email addresses and phone numbers. As for the warning in the section labeled Your Data and Gemini Apps, you'll find the following sentence: please don't enter confidential information in your conversations or any data you wouldn't want a reviewer to see or Google to use to improve our products, services, and machine learning technologies. And then well below that statement, you'll find information on how long review data is retained, which Google states Gemini apps conversations that have been reviewed by human reviewers are not deleted when you delete your Gemini apps activity because they are kept separately and are not connected to your Google account. Instead, they are retained for up to 3 years.
Mm.
So, you know,
it's a long time.
It is a long time. Yeah, I was going to ask you what's your thoughts on that as a retention period?
Well, first of all, if it's not stored, you know, in the place in which it was collected, then what are the measures for erasure on that? You know, it says that you can, I read somewhere that you can amend the settings on retention and what data is taken or you know, stored for an extended period of time. But if you have to amend those settings, and that's also not adhering to privacy by design and default either. You know, it's good that you have the options there, don't get me wrong, but
yeah,
you've got to reduce the retention period from 3 years. I mean, I need to look into it further. It might not even work like that, but that's how I interpreted it. Regardless, 3 years is a long time, isn't it? So
yeah, it's a controller's responsibility to ensure that personal data is not retained for any longer than is deemed absolutely necessary for, you know, to meet the purpose of the processing. So it's essential to understand why they, you know, retain that information and what they're using it for, and presumably it's to improve the services that they're delivering. But 3 years is a ridiculous amount of time to analyze you know, people's responses, and surely the things that would improve the services would not necessarily be what you're asking it, or maybe they're looking at what you're asking it and then the way you answered it, perhaps. Maybe that's what they're doing. But 3 years feels like they've just plucked a period out of the sky and just thought, yeah, 3 years, that'll do.
Mm.
And another concern to me is the fact that, yeah, it's great that you can go into your settings and you can alter the retention periods to suit you, but also it's the controller's responsibility to set those, and it's the controller's responsibility, you know, to ensure that it's that the retention periods you know, are as appropriate as necessary, really.
Yeah, with that as well, so they say you know, that they'll try and anonymize data where possible to use it for whatever other purposes, but then also not to disclose any, you know, confidential information that you wouldn't want a reviewer to read. It's like it just seems contradictory to me. So you know, will I be identified from this information or not, and can you take this information? So in what are the levels of anonymity, is that the word? That's a really hard word to say. But how anonymous is the data that you're collecting and using for market research purposes or for improving the system? It's, don't get me wrong, I mean, these are concerning points to consider. But at the same time, I do feel like this is probably the most transparent information I've found in comparison to like ChatGPT and I've read another one. But yeah, I just think that at least you know what you're bargaining for here. The warning, you're not to disclose your information, it's there in black and white. So I suppose it's just trying to stay conscious the whole time. You know, at the end of the day, even though this is a little bit more transparent and they're warning you against disclosing any information you wouldn't want somebody to know, then how far does that go? What is done with it?
Yeah, no, there's only so much that they can do, isn't there? I guess it's the thing is with AI, it's been in the news a lot, hasn't it, recently? There's clearly issues with it in terms of the data scraping that they pull offline, you know, whether that's lawful. And then I guess, did you see also that ChatGPT have just released a new AI thing where you can kind of give it a description and it will turn that text into a video?
No.
Yeah, I think I saw that on Twitter this morning, or X, as we now call it. But that was pretty terrifying as well, that, you know, some people just put some, there was some quite ominous things that people had put forward for AI to create. But, you know, it's only going to get better, isn't it? And it feels like AI is going a lot quicker than the laws and the regulations are being developed under it.
Yeah. Although on that point, I saw that the European Parliament committees have voted in favour of the AI Act. It's very EU focused today, but I just thought that that was worth mentioning. So, you know, they might be catching up. So the new law regulates the development and deployment of AI systems while banning specific applications considered too dangerous. So the approach will be risk based and will determine whether fundamental rights, democracy, the rule of law and environmental sustainability are adequately protected, with the highest risk AI systems subject to the strictest rules. So Parliament has banned a number of applications, including emotion recognition in workplaces and schools, social scoring and AI systems that manipulate human behaviour or exploit personal vulnerabilities. But despite criticism, a number of exceptions have been included for law enforcement, which is interesting. But yeah, I mean, even just the fact that that's in conversation, you know, AI to recognize emotions in schools, it's just a bit creepy, isn't it? I mean, at least it's being banned, but it's being banned in the EU. Who knows what might be happening across the world?
Yeah, what comes to a point where you can't ban it? Do you know what I mean? If it's that clever and it's that, I don't really know. I feel so out of my depth sat here talking about AI, but it just doesn't feel good to me. It's just, you know, you get that gut feeling and you just think we're just taking it too far.
Yeah. Miles was telling us the other day, wasn't he, that he's reading a book. I've forgotten the guy's name, Miles, if you want to say.
It's Mo Gowdat, I think, isn't it?
Yeah. So he used to work like very high up in Google, in an innovative, I'm using all the tongue twisters today, innovative role. So he, you know, be creating and testing new technologies and whatnot. And he was really high in the AI field. And then since then, he warns against the dangers of AI and he's quite worried. He doesn't work there any longer. He's quite worried about where it will take us. And so he's written a book that Miles is reading. And in this book, he says that you should always be polite to AI because you don't know, it is sentient and you don't know what could happen in the future. So you'll get Miles there talking to ChatGPT using his pleases and thank yous extremely. and says that I'll be the first to die because I'm rude. So,
I think I'll be
maybe
along.
Maybe Joe,
I'll
maybe there's your saviour.
Yeah.
If you're that worried.
Miles will be like the jester of AI. He'll be there to keep people occupied. And if he steps out of line, Miles will be next on the list.
He's going to become an extension of AI, not vice versa. He used it yesterday. I'm sorry for slating you on this, Miles, but he was going to use it to write his Valentine's Day card. He's gonna kill me after this.
Yeah, there's a high chance that he will kill you after that, to be fair, but
yeah. Anyway, on romantic AI applications, so I've also seen that romantic AI chatbots are a privacy nightmare. So there's been some concern about this in a couple of articles, I think around the Valentine's Day discussion. So new research by the Mozilla Foundation has found serious security and privacy concerns with romance and companion chatbots. The analysis reveals these chatbots collect a large amount of user data, use weak password protections and lack transparency about ownership and AI models. Additionally, they use trackers that send information to companies in Russia and China, as well as Google and Facebook. The report warns of the potential for hackers to abuse the chat messages of these services. And oh my gosh, that got me worried, to be fair. Not that I use one of these, but imagine somebody who's, I mean, we you know, people make jokes and we think about these AI robots that people are going to start buying if they don't already exist. I think they actually might. And be in a relationship with them, essentially. You know, it's people get attached to these things. So you can only imagine the conversations that I had with these chatbots with, you know, people willing to have them. And imagine that information getting leaked.
It's a privacy nightmare, isn't it? Like the headline says, in terms of the fact that you know, I don't want to, draw a line and, you know, make judgment, but you could probably guess that the person that's kind of open up to talking to an AI robot is you know, probably going to be quite vulnerable as a person. So it's very sort of, yeah, it's not good, is it? You know, disclosing special category data and data that's probably going to cause you and other people risk that, you know, God knows where that could end up and whose hands it could end up in. So,
yeah, it's a bit dark, but it reminds me of that Black Mirror episode. Is it Shut Up and Dance?
Not seen it.
If you know, you know. It's disturbing, but for multiple reasons, as all Black Mirror episodes. But yeah, that one's it's unsettling.
Well, we've spoken quite a lot about news and things and articles that we've seen in the week in the news this week. But I actually wanted to talk about a case that I had this week. So the new customer that I'm working with part time had an incident that happened in the workplace. And I just wanted to get yours and people that are listening's opinion on whether it constitutes a personal data breach. So what happened is an employee of our customer was in a meeting, and someone else in that meeting made an inappropriate comment. And I think it was along the lines of a sexist comment. It was, call it inappropriate, and it's something that, you know, shouldn't be discussed in the workplace. Anyway, the person that overheard the comment went to HR and asked for their advice. Rather than giving them advice, HR proceeded to inform the person who made the comments, manager, about them making an inappropriate comment in the workplace. And then obviously the person who made the comment found out that an employee, they found out who it was, had made a complaint essentially to HR or was about to. So they came to us and asked whether it constitutes a personal data breach and what the implications are under the GDPR.
So to reiterate that, there was a meeting had and somebody made a inappropriate comment about the data subject in this instance. The data subject went to HR for advice on this. Well, and they asked what context though, to complain or?
Yeah, so someone's made this inappropriate comment. What should I do? Do I take this to you guys and you deal with it, or do I go directly to the manager? I don't know. They didn't specify on the advice they were asking for, but they went to HR, and the issue here is that HR, without the person's authorization, kind of just went above and beyond and just kind of reported it
to the individual's line manager.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
So it wasn't a report as such in the first instance. It was just, you know, what should we do sort of thing.
Yeah. So, it seems like they were potentially following procedure or HR thought they were following procedure.
Yeah.
So I suppose there wouldn't be a breach of organizational measures. But I suppose if you take it a step back, is the personal, let's say a breach of security first. So a breach of security, so that could be organizational, technical or physical measures, really. So it's, could it be human error, maybe?
Yeah, possibly.
Yeah. It's not technical because it was, you know, conversation. Personal data involved? I suppose that's the second point. So if there's been a breach of security, arguably, you know, either way, has there been a breach of personal data?
Yeah,
it's a tricky one.
No, it is a tricky one, and that's why I wanted to discuss it on here, because I'm sure it's something that happens quite common in an organization. And the way I actually rang Phil and we had a conversation about it, and the first thing that we kind of came to the conclusion was I felt it was a breach of confidentiality, but Phil argued that it was probably more a breach of confidence. Then we kind of took a step that says, so HR disclosed it, but they didn't say to the person, you know, you can talk to us about anything, but if it meets a certain threshold or a certain criteria, then there's nothing that we can do other than go and inform the person. So that happened, and obviously if it's policy that HR do that, then it could also be a breach of policy. And then we kind of took a step back and thought, okay, hang on a minute. So when they went to HR, was it a verbal conversation? And it was. And obviously it wasn't intended to be filed or, you know, structured in any way. So then we kind of thought, is this even caught by the GDPR? So, you know, there's always lots to unpick with a personal data breach. And like always, it's always devil in the detail.
Yeah, that's a good point on is it even caught, to be fair. I never thought of it in that sense. But then could you argue that when that individual takes it to, I think it probably just comes down to the context of when that individual took it to the HR, because if it was just for a bit of advice and, you know, they specified, obviously didn't in this sense, but in this case, but if they specified, look, I'm just asking for advice here, I don't want you to take this any further yet, then they shouldn't take it further. But if they're filing a report, then surely that becomes personal data at that point, because it's, you know, they're recording it, so...
Yeah, but obviously it was verbally at the time and it wasn't intended to be structured. But obviously then, if they didn't go any further, they gave the advice back, then they made a report, then obviously it would. But at the time of the disclosure, it was just a verbal conversation, so it wasn't caught. But let's say it was caught. There was a breach as such, I guess, or a security incident, let's say. Has it led to, loss, alteration, unauthorized disclosure? And I guess the final thing to kind of unpick of that is if that it has met all the things previous, Phil kind of made the point that is it unauthorized disclosure? Because does the organization feel that the manager has the right to that information? Because obviously of the situation that's at hand. And he probably says they probably would, but obviously it's up for the organization to determine that.
Yeah, there's a lot of that similar talk in the chat, to be fair, saying that it depends on the organization's code of conduct and disciplinary policy, etc. But yeah, I mean, you've got some thought-provoked, some conversation going up in the chat here. It's an interesting one, I think, as well. It comes down to that it depends, again, with the context around the situation, that we probably need a little bit more information, but... There's probably arguments for both, but probably leaning more towards it wasn't a breach.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Interesting one. Thank you. I've had another interesting case as well this week. So it wasn't even a case per se, but I was on a call with one of my accounts earlier this week. And the reason they initially engaged with us at DPP is because they had a complaint from a tenant, so they're a housing association, about the use of Experian. So in the past, this housing association relied on legitimate interests for collecting data for the purposes of Experian under what's called the rental exchange. So basically that is where you can use your rent. Like, you know, if you're paying rent, you can use that towards your credit score to improve your credit score. So adding that to, you know, your assessment of what your score would be. So if you're a regular rent payer, is never late, that can improve your score, basically. So, yeah, they initially relied on legitimate interest, but this individual put in a subject access request, saw that that they'd been sharing data with Experian for this rental exchange. But this individual was saying, I never consented to this. I didn't know you were doing this. I'm going to complain to the ICO. So the Housing Association obviously panicked and, you know, came to us, and we broke it down. We looked at what information was sent out when they first undertook this, this program. And, sorry, I'm getting sidetracked by the chat. And what lawful basis was relied on at the time, etc. So they found, you know, they did some digging and saw that they were relying on legitimate interest. They'd done an assessment, they'd informed everyone at the time, you know, they'd got all the ducks in a row, essentially. And obviously, you know, when people complain that they've not consented to something, it's not always a valid complaint, just through lack of understanding of other lawful basis available. So that was all fine. And then from there, we decided that we're probably best with them moving to consent to avoid the situation in the future, just for complete transparency if people aren't really aware of it. And yeah, everything was fine until this week, where I had a call with the Sales Association. We were just having a catch up, and Experian have come to them and said that we want you to send all of your tenants' data as a automatic opt-in, or we want to seize the contract, essentially. So the housing association was backed into a corner and they decided, you know, whether they should or not give all of their customer data, especially, you know, considering various factors such as the fact they'd moved to consent, and decided, no, we're going to stick with, you know, with the current arrangements. And for a little bit of context, only two people had consented when they moved to consent as well. So the contract essentially ceased. And I just thought that was really interesting. If Experian are going around to all these different housing associations or organizations saying, give us all your data or we don't want to work with you, it morally does not, ethically or whatever, does not sit right with me at all. But what are the what are the data protection implications of this? Are there any? I don't know. It didn't sit right with me. I want to get your thoughts on it. You, Joe, and everyone listening. As long as we can keep up with the chat, go easy.
Yeah, it's certainly an interesting one, and it doesn't sit right with me either. It seems unethical 100% in terms of the fact that they're kind of trying to force the hand of the housing association to hand the data over. I don't think there's any GDPR implications at that moment, but I think once then the organisation passes the data over, under the threat of losing the contract with Experian, I think that's when there's probably implications of the process in not being fair, lawful and transparent, I'd probably say.
Yeah. It's a tricky one, isn't it? Because it doesn't seem right that those who do consent can't have access to this scheme because of, you know, the wider issue. But then I suppose that that's not really a GDPR issue either, because no data is being misused. And if you think about it, you know, if the police made a request for CCTV to any organization, it's up to that organization whether they want to provide that footage or not. So it is in, you know, the controller's hand as is, which is the housing association in this instance, and only Experian become a data controller once they receive that information. But even with that, I don't understand why they would be interested in cutting this off if they're collecting data of probably every individual in the UK anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously there's reasons for it, probably commercial reasons, but yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it was just a moral issue or a data protection issue, really. Because if you think about it then as well, what about those organisations that do want to provide this service and they say, right, okay, we'll give you it. You know, they don't know how to handle these situations, and it's a risk.
Yeah, it is a risk, and the more risk in the fact that if, say, you want to help, you know, your tenants, you know, you've got a legitimate interest to help your tenants, and Experian is saying, no, we're going to leave it, and you're relying on consent for that that processing, you might think, oh God, we've only got two people that have consented here. Maybe if we switch to legitimate interest as a lawful basis, we'll be able to just send everyone over. And then obviously in turn, Experian's actions have, you know, compromised the housing association's legal obligations under the UK GDPR by altering to a lawful basis that is not appropriate anymore. So I understand, obviously, it's the housing association's duty to ensure that an appropriate lawful basis is made, but you know, if you've not got the best sort of knowledge of data protection, you might just think, you know, it's we're just trying to help out our tenants. You know, I don't see the issue of why sending over all our tenants' information in order to get rent exchange is such a bad thing. And like you say, they might sit and think, oh yeah, but Experian will probably have their data anyway, because they've probably used Experian to check their credit scores. So, you know, what's really the issue if we just send this over in terms of getting rent exchange? And then that opens up a whole can of worms, doesn't it? In terms of, you know, you'll get complaints from all your tenants that as they had previous when relying on legitimate interest, that they didn't have their consent to send that data over. And of course, we know how hard it is to change lawful basis, to go from legitimate interest to consent back to legitimate interest. It's just not a good idea, is it? And it just feels like Experian are trying to twist the housing associations into doing something that they probably shouldn't.
Well, thank you for that. That was some good insight. It just that, like I said, it doesn't sit right with me. But I mean, I don't know where we sit with legitimate interest in terms of sharing data with Experian now. I would still definitely urge on the side of consent, especially, you know, for reasons like this, where it doesn't seem to have the data subjects intentions or protection of their data at heart in every case, really. But I was doing some digging about it because I remember them being under fire in 2020. So the ICO had, I think, placed an enforcement action on them for non-compliance with Article 6, subsection 1 of the GDPR. So that's fair, lawful and transparent processing, amongst other things. So it related to the privacy information that they provided, especially to say that they weren't collecting this data directly from individuals and the lawful basis relied on. So they were relying on legitimate interest, but the ICO argued that there wasn't, let's say, an objective, appropriate legitimate interest assessment undertaken. So it favoured Experian a little bit too much. And yeah, there was an enforcement action placed on them. Since then, in, I think it was it February last year? Around this time last year, the first tier tribunal, so Experian appealed the decision and the first tier tribunal favoured more on side with Experian, saying that, you know, things could be done in relation to issuing privacy information, but the decision on the legitimate interest was probably misinterpreted by the experienced or professional examiner of the situation, saying that, especially in relation to credit reference agencies and collecting their data, that this is an advantage of the individual because it improves the credit score rather than, which, you know, if they didn't, or provides a more accurate representation of their credit score, which without that would be a risk to the individual. So I found that an interesting take, to be fair. And I found it quite funny as well, because I was looking on a few different websites and articles just around this, and most of the articles were saying, you know, most of the ICO's decision, most of the ICO's arguments have been overturned, etc. And so I got to the ICO's website where it said the first tier tribunal favoured the ICO's decisions in some instances and not in others, and it was just such a different approach to the situation and a little bit more biased in favour of the ICO, obviously, but I just found that quite amusing. But yeah, I mean, I expect to see Experian in the news again at some point, to be honest, because if they're, you know, demanding data in such a way, I don't know if it's a normal approach for some organisations or if they've got justifiable reasons, but it does not sit right with me at all. You know, at least explain the impact of this and the reasons for it. But yeah, we'll see.
Yeah.
Going down a rabbit hole. Well, with that anyway, it has been an hour, so we will leave it there. But thank you everyone so much for joining. Really enjoyed this session. Even though Phil has been missed, I think he'll be back next week for what's it even called? It was a third party one. Anyway, we'll be talking about third party relationships again. So it'll be a part two from a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, we'll be talking about third parties, international transfers, controls, controller relationships, all of that continued from the last time, from about a month or so ago. There'll be loads to unpick with that. But in the meantime, have a great weekend and next of your week. These sessions come around so fast, so I'm sure it won't be too long. But yeah, thank you for joining.
Cheers, guys. Have a great weekend.
And thank you to my partner in crime, Joseph.
Thanks,
see you later.
Bye.